Siren Radio.
I tell you, it's all go. Welcome along to the Midweek Drive Morning Edition live on Siren Radio. In the studio, we have Cathy Manso. How are you, Cathy?
I'm well. Good morning. How are you?
Excellent. We also have an ace creative writer. That would be Robert Weston. How are you, Robert?
Hello. Yeah, good morning. I am very good.
Splendid. Up next, we'll have Dr. Hiwi Fashihi, who'll be talking about the importance of a sunscreen and skin protection and such like. Have you put your sunscreen on today, Robert?
Wow, I have.
Good.
Yeah.
Nice. This is back to see. And Kathy?
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. Oil-based today, because, well, you know, the sun is really out.
Exactly.
I use CFC-free aerosol. Is my go-to.
Excuse me. I'm a super goop kind of gal.
Oh, okay. Super goop.
Yeah.
Okay, I like that. All right. Yeah, I'm more of a light spritzing.
Ah, there we go.
And we'll be talking about the Lincolnshire Show.
Pale and interesting. Those were the days where we used to keep out of the sun and, of course, avoid the notion of overly exposing our skins to the sunlight and so forth. Then, of course, we got around us to the end of the 20th century and wear sunscreen, the advice that obviously was given by Baz Luhrmann. Of course, that's still the case today. But how many of us are actually doing it? Well, not as many as perhaps should be, with 28% of UK adults only apparently wearing sun protection on sunny days. And the same number actually believing that sun cream is just a seasonal thing. Well, to actually address these myths, we're delighted to welcome top dermatologist, Dr. Hiwi Fashihi. How are you, Dr. Hiwi?
Oh, very well. Thank you. And thank you for having me on the show.
Excellent. It's great to connect with your good self. But I must admit, I thought this message about skincare had been getting through, but clearly it hasn't. And the fact of the matter is, many of us are wearing sunscreen and probably running a big risk of all kinds of melanomas, skin cancers and such like.
Absolutely. I think this research by La Roche-Posay has really highlighted that as much education that we have out there, there's still a lot more to do. I'm always surprised when I speak to patients in clinic about their sort of lack of understanding of why we wear sun cream and when we should apply it and how much we should apply. And so I think it's great that we're chatting about it today. And that same survey actually showed unbelievably that 1 in 10 16 to 24 year olds actually still use sunbeds regularly. So for all these reasons, I think discussing the importance of sun protection, and that's not just sun cream, that's actually being sensible in the sun, covering up, you know, avoiding the midday sun, is really, really important.
And just because it happens to be cloudy doesn't necessarily mean to say that UV radiation can't still be penetrating. I mean, that's also something that I think people often fail to realize.
Absolutely. So if you just talk about ultraviolet a little bit, so ultraviolet, from my perspective, in the acute phase causes sunburn. That's how it harms your skin. And obviously in the long term, it puts you at much higher risk of getting skin cancer and premature skin aging. But when I talk about ultraviolet with patients, I sort of say it's divided into ultraviolet A and ultraviolet B. And ultraviolet B is much shorter wavelength, sort of directly damages your DNA, and that's the wavelengths that cause skin cancer and sunburn. But ultraviolet A is what you're hinting at there, is it's a longer wavelength. It actually comes through cloud cover. It penetrates thin clothing. It comes through windows. And it has been implicated particularly in premature skin aging, but there is a lot of data to say that it can also cause skin cancer. So on a cloudy day, in the summer or even in the winter, you're still at risk of ultraviolet damage. And so for that reason, I'd ask people to put their sun cream on every day, and then they know they're protected.
Do people still get confused when it comes to looking for the right kind of sun protection, whether it's 30%, 50%? We see lots of things on labels and bottles and so on. Is that pretty much understood now, that you need high sun protection factors to ensure that you're fully protected and so on?
It's so confusing. And although in this research project by La Roche-Posay, 80% of people said that they understood what all the labeling on sunscreen bottles mean. I don't actually think that's true, because when I see patients and we talk about sun protection, there seems to be a lot of confusion over what the numbers mean. So just to clarify that, the SPF, the sun protection factor, is purely an indication of UVB protection. So these are the burning rays. And now sunscreens don't just protect against UVB. There's very good protection against UVA as well, and that's a different sort of nomenclature on the sunscreen bottles. So there may be a star rating, like you find in the boot sunscreens, or there may be a PPD number, which you find in other sunscreens. So what you're looking for is a sunscreen that has quite a high SPF, so definitely above 30, preferably 50, and then good UVA protection as well, and that way you know you've got the best protection all round. But the other thing, if I may add, is that people come to clinic and go, oh, I wouldn't wear an SPF 50. That's too strong. It's too heavy. But the way that these SPF numbers and the UVA protection numbers are calculated, they're calculated in a laboratory with the sunscreen being applied 2 milligrams per centimeter squared. So if you're thinking about that in real life, that's about 2 millimeters thick on the skin. And lovely researchers have looked into this, and most of us can't do that. Most of us apply a quarter of that thickness onto the skin. And that means your SPF doesn't just drop down by a quarter, it actually drops exponentially. So with an SPF 50, if you apply it the way you apply in normal life, you're getting about an SPF 5 or 10, which is still great. It means you can stay out there 5 times as long as you could have, depending on your how long it takes for you to sunburn. But this idea that an SPF 50 is too strong is just not true. So I say to people, particularly those at higher risk, use an SPF 50 and apply it a good 20 minutes before you leave the house, and then reapply it every couple of hours if you're going to be out and about, particularly in the summer months.
We're about a week away from the Lincolnshire Show, huge event here in the county of Lincolnshire. Obviously 2 days in which we hope usually for some good weather and sun being there. Presumably also you should be applying your sunscreen even if you're driving in a car or sort of traveling there, because that's also important. It should be a habit one gets into as a matter of course, as opposed to, well, we'll drive through the sun, then we'll get there, then we might put some sun cream on.
I totally agree. This is where most people go wrong, that they wait until they've had a bit of exposure, whether it's in the car or actually at the fair, before they put their sunscreen on. If you put it on first thing in the morning before you leave, you know you've got the first layer on your skin. And also in the car, you just assume that because you're in the car, you're protected. But as we said before, the UVA rays with these longer wavelengths penetrate through glass. And so you're still damaging your skin sitting in the car. So apply it to all exposed areas before you leave the house, and then you can top up when you get to the fair. And I hope you have some nice weather for it.
To paraphrase the old classic line with respect to canines, of course, that sun protection is for life, not just for June. That whole notion of actually ensuring that, you know, even if it seems as though, what, sunscreen wearing that in November, December in the Northern Hemisphere, ridiculous. Maybe it isn't so ridiculous, is it?
Absolutely not. And if you speak to a dermatologist, most of us actually wear sun cream on our face every day throughout the year, almost as a sort of a moisturizer under our makeup, if you're wearing makeup. So actually, if the dermatologists are doing it, you have to ask why. And it's because it will protect you, will reduce your rate of skin cancer. Bearing in mind, most skin cancer occur on exposed areas. It will reduce your rate of skin cancer, and actually it'll make you your skin age much more slowly. And so all those problems, when I see patients now in their 60s and 70s and they're sort of saying, oh gosh, I wish I'd protected more when I was younger, you can do that every day and prevent all those problems in the future.
This is a challenge that affects presumably human beings all over the place. I mean, sometimes I've had folk who've actually said, oh, we're from Miami, we don't worry about the sun, it's all sorted out there. Presumably these challenges are global.
Absolutely. If the sun is out, particularly if the sun is out, but actually the sun is always there, apart from a nighttime when it is not there. But if it's daylight, there is ultraviolet about. So if you want to protect from ultraviolet, and because we have so much evidence and we know what ultraviolet does to the DNA in our skin, does to the cells in our skin, then you should protect against it. And it doesn't matter where you are in the world. In fact, it's worse in some places. So Australia and New Zealand, they get much higher levels of UV and they need to protect even more. And they've done some great campaigns over the years to improve their sun protection and hopefully in time reduce their rates of skin cancer.
And La Roche-Posay has also put their proverbial money where their mouth is, because they've also opened up, I see, a series of pop-up screenings at Westfield Shopping Centre in which people can possibly even meet your good self, Dr. Heaver.
Well, I'll be there on Saturday, but a lot of my very eminent colleagues will be there this week. And so, yes, if you want to come and learn more about sunscreens, have all those things explained again, and, you know, talk about what to look out for in your moles, and, you know, how to hopefully catch any skin cancers early and get them treated, then absolutely come to Westfields the whole of this week and there's someone there to help.
And finally, of course, where can people go to find out further information about what we've been chatting about today, Dr. Heaver?
So lots of information actually on the La Roche-Posay website, but I always mention the British Association of Dermatologists website that has lots of really well-written patient information leaflets to talk about photoprotection, sunscreens, and even skin cancers.
Dr. Heaver Fassie, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on, and may your encounters with the sun be always pleasant.
Pleasure, Alex. Nice to chat to you.
Ladies and gentlemen of the class of 99, where... sunscreen. If I could offer you only one tip for the future, sunscreen would be it. The long-term benefits of sunscreen have been proved by scientists, whereas the rest of my advice has no basis more reliable than my own meandering experience. I will dispense this advice now. Enjoy the power and beauty of your youth. Oh, never mind. You will not understand the power and beauty of your youth. They've faded. But trust me, in 20 years, you'll look back at photos of yourself and recall in a way you can't grasp now how much possibility lay before you and how fabulous you really looked. You are not as fat as you imagine. Don't worry about the future. Or worry, but know that worrying is as effective as trying to solve an algebra equation by chewing bubblegum. The real troubles in your life are apt to be things that never crossed your worried mind, the kind that blindsides you at 4 p.m. on some idle Tuesday. Do one thing every day that scares you. Sing. Don't be reckless with other people's hearts. Don't put up with people who are reckless with yours. Floss. Don't waste your time on jealousy. Sometimes you're ahead, sometimes you're behind. The race is long, and in the end, it's only with yourself. Remember compliments you receive. Forget the insults. If you succeed in doing this, tell me how. Keep your old love letters. Throw away your old bank statements. Stretch. Don't feel guilty if you don't know what you want to do with your life. The most interesting people I know didn't know at 22 what they wanted to do with their lives. Some of the most interesting 40-year-olds I know still don't. Get plenty of calcium. Be kind to your knees. You'll miss them when they're gone. Maybe you'll marry. Maybe you won't. Maybe you'll have children. Maybe you won't. Maybe you'll divorce at 40. Maybe you'll dance the funky chicken on your 75th wedding anniversary. Whatever you do, don't congratulate yourself too much or berate yourself either. Your choices are half chance. So are everybody else's. Enjoy your body. Use it every way you can. Don't be afraid of it or what other people think of it. It's the greatest instrument you'll ever own. Dance. Even if you have nowhere to do it but in your own living room. Read the directions, even if you don't follow them. Do not read beauty magazines. They will only make you feel ugly. Get to know your parents. You never know when they'll be gone for good. Be nice to your siblings. They're your best link to your past and the people most likely to stick with you in the future. Understand that friends come and go, but with a precious few, you should hold on. Work hard to bridge the gaps in geography and lifestyle, because the older you get, the more you need the people you knew when you were young. Live in New York City once, but leave before it makes you hard. Live in Northern California once, but leave before it makes you soft. Travel. Accept certain inalienable truths. Prices will rise, politicians will philander, you too will get old. And when you do, you'll fantasize that when you were young, prices were reasonable, politicians were noble, and children respected their elders. Respect your elders. Don't expect anyone else to support you. Maybe you have a trust fund, maybe you'll have a wealthy spouse. You never know when either one might run out. Don't mess too much with your hair, or by the time you're 40, it will look 85. Be careful whose advice you buy, but be patient with those who supply it. Advice is a form of nostalgia. Dispensing it is a way of fishing the past from the disposal, wiping it off, painting over the ugly parts, and recycling it for more than it's worth. But trust me, on the sunscreen.
It's almost here. Almost here, indeed. A matter of days away now from the 138th Lincolnshire Show. Well, we'll just have to find out exactly what is happening with respect to that, because we're delighted to welcome a newbie to talk about the Lincolnshire Show this year. In our usual pre-show review and indeed tease ahead to the two-day event, which frankly the whole year waits for, of course, from the Lincolnshire Agricultural Society. It's Tim Slight. How are you, Tim?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Are you okay?
Well, yeah, and great to connect with you, good self, and obviously looking forward to the show, as I say, the 20th and 21st, or rather 21st and 22nd of June. Are you excited?
Yeah, we are. Yeah, we're at that nervous stage at the minute where everything's starting to happen on site. So a lot of the marquee contractors are on site and everything's starting to feel a bit real now.
Now, I mean, I cast my mind back to the start of the century when, I've got to be honest, I didn't know anything about the Lincolnshire Show, even though obviously I was teaching at the University of Lincoln and still am and still working through that. And then I think I took part in my first one probably about 2002, 2003. And, you know, it's just an amazing event. I mean, this is something which effectively, you know, just looking at the statistics from the website, 60,000 visitors, 6,000 school children, 500 exhibitors each and every year. It is pretty much the go-to show in Lincolnshire. Share with us your own background. How did you get involved with the whole thing?
Well, I'm an accountant by trade. That's what I trained as. I worked in accountancy for many years, decided to do something different, looked into getting to the charity, because obviously Lincolnshire Agricultural Society is a charity, registered charity. So came into this, and yeah, so I've been here for about 4.5 years now. So yeah, we have a bit of a break for COVID, but yeah, shows the pinnacle of our year, basically. So it's what we work towards. It's a great event, and we love putting it on.
I was going to talk about that, because obviously the COVID years, as they shall ever be known, even that didn't quite stop the tremendous work of the Agricultural Society in terms of getting a show together and putting it on, because of course you went online for those
we
2 years,
yeah.
and sort of still kind of goes, so you know, it all clicks into place from that. Last year, of course, I was sharing earlier about how it was my first Lincolnshire show about 20 years ago. Last year, it was the first ever Lincolnshire show for our ace American correspondent, originally from Miami, Kathy Manso. So this time around will be Kathy's second show. So, Kathy, we've just started basically sounding out the whole thing. Kathy, are you looking forward to this Lincolnshire show event?
Absolutely. It was such a good time last year. I can only imagine it's going to be better this year.
Tim, that's the bar that's been set there. You know, last year was great. This year's going to be better. So what can we look forward to? What are the highlights that will make Kathy go back to America saying, God, it just gets better each year?
Yeah, so basically, obviously, we still try and keep it a traditional agricultural society show. So we've still got all the usual attractions, the large agricultural dealers, the equine, the livestock. We have got some new events this year. We've got the Blue Light Zone, which is new for this year, which is basically putting all the emergency services together in one place so they can highlight all the great work that they do. And they'll be doing demonstrations in the countryside ring. We're actually one of three shows, which is a qualifier for Britain's Fittest Farmers, which is all about physical exercise, mental health, that kind of thing. So there's us, there's Devon, and there's Royal Highland in Scotland. So we're really proud to be nominated for or qualify for that. We've got the Potting Shed this year as well, which is local experts talking about horticulture, all things to do with gardening and green, that kind of thing. Jerry Green's coming. They're going to be doing some dog shows. We've got the Young Farmers. They've got a new thing this year, which is a bale rolling competition. So we'll see how that goes. Whenever the Young Farmers are involved, it's always lively, shall we say.
Yeah, just to point out, the bale rolling is not actually getting a former Real Madrid and Tottenham Hotspur footballer and actually rolling him around the whole thing. It's actually bales of hay. It's important to actually just work through that process, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Kathy, have you got any questions you want to put to Tim before we start talking about the importance of the events to the Lincolnshire area and beyond?
Absolutely. I wanted to know, because you're now at the last week of preparations before the show, what has to happen this last week? I know it takes a whole year to prepare for this, but what are the final things that need to happen to be ready for Wednesday?
Well, basically, grass cutting. You know, we're a massive site, so we take a lot of grass cutting. So we finished grass cutting now. All the marquee contractors are on site, so they're putting all the marquees up, and as we expect at the minute. And then from probably Thursday, all the exhibitors will start coming on site, and then we'll work straight through the weekend, ready for Tuesday night. We've got a massive team of stewards, 200 stewards who come and help put the show on, volunteer, give up the time, you know, massive support for society. So they'll start coming over the next few days and helping us. So yeah, real team effort over the next week. There's a lot we can do during the year, but it's always those last couple of weeks are just a bit manic.
Over the last few months, of course, Tim, we've seen the end of the Lincolnshire Christmas market, which means that basically, as I've always said, it's the food and gift fair at the Lincolnshire Showground that now is the authentic start to the Christmas season. But let's talk about the Lincolnshire show. I mean, when we're looking at for publicity, etc., certainly the Christmas market was something which people knew a bit about Lincoln, but it'd been going for a lot less, start off in the 1980s, of course. How important, from your own perspective, Tim, is the show to the region, to the rural folk, first and foremost? Because Lincoln is, with its potatoes and many other things, of course, home of the Yellow Bellies, etc., primarily an agricultural county.
Yeah, it's massively important to us. You know, we have a massive membership who really appreciate everything that we put on at the showground. You know, it's not just the agricultural dealers that come, it's all the allied trade as well. members come from far and wide. They like to come. It's a day for people to socialize. They get out of the house. They come and enjoy 2 days of entertainment. It's really important for the rural community that they actually come and see what we're doing as a society and what's going on in the local region. You know, we're massive promoters of all things local. So, you know, it's great that people can come and see the great things that the county's doing.
And Cathy and myself last week were obviously at the Bramham Horse Trials. And obviously, congratulations to Pippa Funnel for actually winning that this year. One of the things we got from Bramham, because we'd been around briefly the first time after COVID, they'd had a 2-year gap for COVID, but they felt that they were just now that we're getting back into the swing of things. So that kind of energy and pre-COVID stuff was actually there, very much in place. As I mentioned, Lincolnshire Show went online for COVID. Last year was the first one back pretty much where we were back to full force. Do you feel again that actually it's almost as though, what was that COVID-19 thing after all about?
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, last year we everybody was still in the dark. You know, we wasn't quite sure how things were going to go. Ticket sales were really good for last year, a lot better than we thought there was going to be. We thought there's still that nervousness. This year there just seems to be a real buzz about, you know, this is probably the first year where people aren't thinking about COVID and people are just looking to get back. You know, ticket sales are slightly up on last year, which again is great, which again probably reinforces the fact that, you know, people are probably more willing to come out and do things. And, you know, we just want to go, we're a massive space, we're open space, so if anybody does have any concerns, they don't need to worry. We're more than well equipped. So yeah, come and enjoy the day.
I was going to say ticket sales being up is obviously good news for accountants everywhere, but anyway, that's another line entirely. Let's talk about your advice for newbies, people who might be listening to this, who might be in the same position that Cathy was in last year, that I was in 20 years ago, that you were, of course, have been in, etc. What advice would you give to somebody who's thinking, what the hey, let's go then, let's see, what would you suggest they should be doing?
I think first and foremost, get here early. You know, we open at 8 o'clock in the morning. It's a massive site. There's so much to see, so much to do. We close at 6 and you can come for the full day and still not see it all. There's that much to do and see. So really, for first time people, you know, come enjoy it, get here early and just enjoy everything that Lincolnshire's got to offer.
I'd also suggest making sure you wear sunscreen to ensure that you've got something there, because usually we tend to have at least one day which is blistering hot. Sometimes we get different weathers on second days, but it's worthwhile just making sure that skin protection is actually there. And as I was informed recently, you need to put that on before you actually arrive rather than when you arrive, just to make sure that things are actually there. So a bit of a health and safety sort of point from that. Tim, I'm very impressed with the fact that without any bidding whatsoever, we've had matching white shirts today with open collars. So that proves that obviously, you know, we're on the same level from that perspective. What are you most looking forward to for this year's show?
I'm just looking forward to seeing a lot of familiar faces, new faces around the showground. Really excited about the Blue Light Zone this year. You know, the emergency services provide a really valuable service to everything that people do throughout the county. So I'm really glad that they've got the place to come and highlight what they do. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing what they've got to offer this year.
And Cathy, any other questions you'd like to put to Tim at present?
Sure. So one of my favorite events, which I did not know was going to be one of my favorite events, was the puppy parade. And I was curious, what's going to be one of your favorite events to attend this year?
I'm looking forward to the, like I say, Jerry Green dog show. I'm looking forward to that. You know, anything to do with four legs, I'm all for. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing that this year, see what they're going to do this year. And the Young Farmers Bear rolling. I don't know what to expect from that.
Maybe it will be actually Gareth Bale who'll actually come through, and Christian Bale, the actor. You know, you kind of have a mixture of things. You have an actor and a footballer who's actually being rolled together in a car. I mean, you know, it's Young Farmers, Tim, so who knows what could actually happen on that basis.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, maybe next year.
Tim, it's been awesome connecting with your good self. It's been your debut as far as Siren Radio's Midweek Drive has been concerned. I'll say the words because we are actually not in the studio at present. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on this, your Midweek Drive Live debut?
It's been very nice, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Well, the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you actually on the show itself to hopefully grab a few words with you in situ? Will you be kind enough to have a chat with us then?
Yeah, of course we will. No problem.
I've been dreaming, friendly faces, I've got so much time to kill. Just imagine people distance. All these mountains are just some tiny hills. Why?
It was like a foray into enemy territory. There was a mist encircling Covent Garden as I crept out of the shadows and saw my prey, the glowing lights of Frog. The front of the restaurant was wreathed in flowers. Just the opening line of a Sitwell Stirs It Up, which actually has the line, William Sitwell, I'm happy to be proved so wrong. Let's find out more from our ace culinary expert. It is indeed William Sitwell back on the Midweek Drive live. How are you, sir?
Yeah, good morning, Alex. I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent.
Well.
So,
gosh, I should have you employed as to do all my audiobooks.
Oh, well, William, obviously I'm sure we can negotiate in some way, shape or form, but, you know, I'm always available for your good self at a substantial discount, it has to be said.
Until our next guest.
Oh. let's motor on. We have the voice in the background there of our ace creative writer, of course, and which is one of the reasons I wanted to launch with that, of course, Robert Weston. I mean, that's William wonderfully shaping the English language in a perfect manner, I feel.
Yeah. Agreed. Alex, hello, William. I don't think we've met. I'm sometimes in the studio. I don't know what you. What am I going to say?
We are office buddies.
William, nice verb use. Wreathed. Good work. There you go.
That's just
got my approval. Apparently, yeah.
That's just the opening paragraph. Kathy Manser, of course, still with us from that perspective. And Kathy, any thoughts that you'd like to raise with William at present, possibly about Frog? Or indeed anything you wish to go down.
Well, I guess, why did you, I guess, what was your impression before for you to feel like that you had to be proven wrong? What occurred in here for people to be ready to read your piece?
I'm just completely fed up with tasting menus. And wherever I go, I'm assaulted by them. I mean, you know, some people think it's a ridiculous thing to complain about, but, I spend my life seeking refuge and trying to swerve tasting menus, and it's a plague across the world. And I wrote about this actually on my website, on my newsletter, Sitwell's Scoop, last week, because I was in Auckland a couple of weeks ago, and there was a restaurant in just outside a little town called Queenstown, called Amersfield, and my hosts, the New Zealand Tourism, were really keen for me to go there. And I said, great, you know, I'd like to go for dinner. And then they told me it's 23 courses. So I said, listen, I just can't do that, please. I just want to have a steak and a, you know, prawn cocktail. That's all I need, and a glass of
And no square water. Plates, for goodness sake, no square plates.
And no square plates. No. And then they said, well, look, regrettably, it's a Monday, you're there, so the place is shut. And I kind of, I heaved a huge sigh of relief. And then the next thing was that the chef discovered I was in town, sent a car, and said he was opening the restaurant specially.
So this is your own version of the film The Menu.
Table for one. But actually, it was extraordinary. And we had, I think, 12 or 14, not 23 courses, and I ate with the chef. And but the thing is, there's a great chef who I met the other day called Dan Evans, and he was working in a pub in Wiveliscombe in Somerset called the White Hart, and Dan Evans used to run the Anglesey Arms, and he's a very well-known sort of below the radar chef, and he was saying, and he put it rather well, that he doesn't want to be challenged by food all the time, you know. And it tallies with a conversation I had with another man called Al Brown, a restaurateur in Auckland, who said the big problem you have when people turn up in a restaurant is everyone is full of anxiety. You don't quite know where your seat is. You want a drink. You need to relax. We turn up in these establishments full of anxiety. And the job of restaurateurs is to ease that anxiety. And I think when you're faced with a huge menu and colossal descriptions and essays from chefs and waiters and managers, it's the opposite of relaxation. You're having to endlessly think and applaud the genius of the chef. And I actually think we have too many of these places, too many explanations, too much complication. And as Dan Evans says, we don't want to be constantly challenged. That actually makes you feel more anxious. So I understand the economics of doing tasting menus, in that you know exactly what you're going to cook. It displays all your talents across a menu that you think is balanced, etc., etc. But when you're a critic and you're faced with them constantly, trust me, it's a nightmare. So when I went to this place, I thought, oh God, here we go again, you know, endless canapes slash snacks and blah-de-blah-de-blah-de-blah. But Adam Handling is an astonishingly talented, gifted chef, was lauded at a very young age, and he's doing marvelous things from sustainability and from how he treats Mother Nature. So, you know, he's an exception to the rule, but I still say tasting menus, enough already, full stop. And actually, I'm not going to be forgiving anymore. I'm just going to stop going there. And also, I think I have to reflect the fact that the British people generally at the moment don't want this kind of stuff. But I mean, frog is good. But did you look at the bottom of the look at the piece on the sidebar? Tell the listeners what it costs.
It is a bit of, I mean, I was saying to Kathy that primarily it's the best use of £400 I can actually think of, or the high side, shall we say. £390, excluding drinks and service, is the tasting menu.
Get that. Now, do you know, a friend of mine went to the Fat Duck last week, okay? Him and his girlfriend. Do you know what it cost them for dinner for two? £1,200.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I applaud these places because there's, it's amazing. People can do this, get away with it, make money, not just get away with it, do well.
I suppose you don't have to do it very often at £1,200 a pop.
It depends, I suppose. If you're a member of the Manchester City football team that's just won the European Cup, sorry, I had to get it in there. But you know, you might sort of think, yeah, then no problem. I mean, Pep Guardiola's given, I think, a six-figure bonus to all the staff as well from his whole side of things. So on that basis,
yeah,
but
better.
There's good reason to celebrate there. William, I was listening to you. I tend to agree with you about tasting menus, but it also brings to mind. I lived in Japan for a long time, and so I ate a lot of bentos and the big restaurant bentos. And I remember a Japanese chef explaining the philosophy of these bentos, where the idea is the contrast makes each of the flavors pop and raises them because the sweets taste sweeter after,
as you head towards the puffer fish,
yeah,
of course,
with the bitter and the, so textures kind of go back and I found it very convincing as a reason to have a sequence of dishes. It's a different, slightly different thing, but I don't know, you brought that to mind as you were.
Oh, it's absolutely true. Listen, I don't mind it once in a while if you really need to think about these things. And you know, there's chefs who play with different kinds of temperature. You know, we're not just talking lukewarm. We're going, you know, 15, 22, 33 degrees, and then playing with different textures. And that's great. You know, if you really feel that you've got absolutely nothing to talk about with the person you're having dinner with, and all you want to do is obsess about the food and worship at the altar of these culinary geniuses. But sometimes you just want to sit there, have a good gas with your buddies, and the food is just one part of it. And I think too often food is demanding to be center stage. And actually, I don't think it should be most of the time. It needs to be a conduit to a great time. And it needs to sate that anxiety. You know, as Al Brown, who has a place in Depot at Auckland, told me the other day, the first thing that he does when people sit down is he gives them a glass of water, and then he sends out some sort of hummus with some chips from the kitchen. Now, the anxious among us often go, I didn't order that. But, you know, he absorbs it in the cover charge or whatever, and so he's not losing money. But get people's food in their faces, get them chatting, get them to enjoy themselves. And this sort of constant interruption, as you have to sit and wait for the explanations. But you're right, yeah, sure. There's so many interesting things within this, but sometimes you just want to talk about politics or the weather. You don't want to sit
or
there
both.
And go, indeed, both, indeed.
Kathy, from your global travels from Malta through Ukraine, through South Africa, Australia, Miami, does that resonate with you, what William's been sharing?
Yeah, I mean, I think... they also, sometimes these places can be kind of a tourist trap. You know, I experience that a lot in South Africa. They'll have all these tasting menus because they're so many exotic things to try. And it's not just, you know, a lot of the more famous ones where there's a bit of a show and, you know, they interact with the guests, which is, to me, it's like, oh, so much anxiety to go through. You have to really be prepared for it. And being, at the time, I was an English teacher, and you'd go to these restaurants once a week because someone's leaving, so you have to go and celebrate and kind of thing. And you're kind of forced into the situation where, you know, as I mean, the cool thing is I have a story that, yeah, I've tried crocodile and zebra now, and and I have no complaints about it. But at the same time, it's like, you know, I just, when you have to go every week, you would prefer not to go with the tasting menu, but it's kind of forced upon you. And you are, I like to think that I'm not picky and I'm willing to try everything. But after a while, you just kind of would like something that can bring you comfort.
So you're very much in William's position of against the tasting menu, though.
Well, I can understand William's position, especially if you're forced upon it. You know, it's nice every once in a while when it's something fun and different and, you know, you're going to try a new experience. But when when I had to do it living in South Africa for 3 months, I did it every week. And after a while, you're like, enough is enough.
Okay, William, next week, Lincolnshire Show is happening. The show season is very much to the fore. Do you still feel that that is a critical aspect of rurality in the 21st century?
Of course, more important than ever. Of course, it depends what's on your show, what's in the show.
This is true, yeah. Well, I think...
A little bit of everything at the Lincoln Show.
We have the parade of cattle. We have the hounds. We have the agricultural machinery. We have the Scottish vendors who've come down across the border to ply us with authentic Highland coats and such like stuff. It's a true wondrous thing. Sadly, it hasn't had William sit well. One of these days, I'm sure we can actually get William to be our official royalty, because Kathy was saying, have we had royalty at the Lincolnshire Show? Well, William will arrive one day, I'm sure.
I'm a big fan of these shows, and actually one of the greatest ones is the sort of specifically Victorian steam pump show down in near Taunton, where you realize that the Industrial Revolution was this huge pollutant when you see all these machines pumping out thick smoke. Yeah, I'm a big fan, and I think that it always brings people together, gets people outside, and it's a wonderful opportunity. There's a food fair in every single one of these as well, so it's very good in supporting small independent producers. So yeah, I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan. And I think there seem to be loads around the country. So the more the merrier. And put your phones down, go to a show. I think it's a great idea.
Exactly. Robert, any little questions for William that have been burning and you need to actually ask? This is your opportunity.
Yeah, actually, I do. As a food writer, often writing, you're often, you know, you're writing about, because I've read a few of your pieces, you're writing about restaurants as a holistic
experience.
Yeah, the atmosphere, the decor, the service, the food, everything. And I was thinking about this in terms of your, as a professional restaurant
journalist, critic,
food critic. You are seeing things that I wouldn't notice in restaurants and highlighting them, and that's great. And I was thinking about when I go to a restaurant, I am very focused on the food, and I wondered if you had had an experience where, a little bit contrary to what you were saying earlier, that you're in a restaurant where the food is so good, it transcends everything else that is maybe bad, you know, a terrible atmosphere. And then you take one bite and you're like, this makes up for it. Have you ever had anything like that?
God, I can't think of something off the top of my head.
Okay, that's fine.
Put me on the spot. I mean, there are places that look like complete hellholes that are rescued by the food.
Lincoln, yeah. For instance.
Oh,
sorry.
Nice one, Alex.
There are also places where the food is terrible and the decor is terrible, but the service is so good that the service rescues it.
Okay.
So sometimes, you know, people forget that service can be so important, and sometimes the food can be wonderful, but the service is so terrible that it destroys the food. But And these places do occasionally rise out of the ashes. So, I mean, you say that I notice things you wouldn't. I suppose, you know, I'm a trained observer. It's my job, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just, it's that idea of looking at a restaurant. It reminded me, my partner is a set designer for the stage. And until we got together, I went to theater for the story and the acting. And maybe I would think about direction and things. And I didn't pay as much attention to what was going on in the background. And then through her, I see all kinds of things now that I didn't see in the theater. And I see something analogous there.
But it's rather like if you're not interested in cars, you buy a car and suddenly you find yourself interested in it.
Yeah.
So yeah, your eyes are open to the new possibilities, you know, and it's great when someone else opens your eyes towards that. So
it's genuinely wonderful. William, what other exciting things are you getting up to that you'd like to flag up? Obviously, we've got the wonderful supper clubs that are actually there. We've got the Sitwell wine scenario. We've got hopefully new textbooks coming through. Where do you wish to point the listener?
Right now, do you know what? Everyone needs a bottle of the Boatman's Drift. Chenin Blanc, South African, light, fruity, flavourful. It's £11, available at williamsitwell.com in my wine store.
Fantastic. I mean, it's perfect. Wouldn't take that opportunity at the BBC, I can tell you. But, you know, from this point of view, happy to do that. The Boatman's Drift. I can see that Kathy, you're already signing it up and making sure that the orders are going in there.
Already writing it down.
Yeah, it's excellent. Which means we segue over to yourself, Kathy, for two final questions for William, please.
Yes, of course. My first question for you, William, is have you had a reasonably interesting Zoom with us today?
I have. It's been both interesting and reasonable.
Nice. Excellent. And will you be joining us again?
I have no choice. I said yes once about 10 years ago, and you guys never stopped.
That's right. We like to imprison our guests.
Yeah. As he looked pointedly at Alex.
Please.
His office is right next to mine.
We're a collaborative organization from that
perspective. That's how I got here.
It must be. We must look at the records, Alex, and see. It must be nearly a decade.
I think, yeah, indeed, actually, yes, the decade has passed, I believe. That we were just at the start of a whole new experience of life, but there we are. It continues ever onwards, and one day I'm sure you will return, William, because that's the important side of things. William said, well, as ever, we salute you, take care, and what should we do now? Well, we'll give you a chance. Would you like The Cause or The Stranglers? Two interesting bands there, one all male, one all female. Which angle are you going to go for?
Which song?
Golden Brown for The Stranglers, Runaway for The Cause.
Oh, give me a break. Obviously Golden Brown. You crazy?
Golden brown, texture like sun, lays me down. My mind, she runs throughout the night. No need to fight, never a frown with golden brown. Every time, just like the last, on her ship, tied to the mast, to distant lands, takes both my hands, never a frown with golden brown. Temptress, through the ages she's heading west, from far away, stays for a day, never a frown with golden brown. Thank you.
technology, is it something we're ever going to actually become the controller of? Who knows? But the smart home tech gap continues to expand, it would seem, with, as we look to the future, all the electric eco homes using heat pumps, battery storage, electric vehicles, and so on. So where's it going to end? Well, maybe the report Untapped, the Home Tech Evolution, commissioned by Samsung UK and Ireland, could conceivably have something to do with that. And to address the whole notion of that particular aspect, we're delighted to welcome James Kitto to the programme. How are you, James?
Hello, I'm well, thank you.
Excellent. So, James, this particular report, I mean, is it a case of fantastic? This is what a techno-fetishist's dream is made of. Or is it a case of we should be a little bit concerned about what we're actually seeing here?
No, not at all. Look, we've commissioned a report to understand consumers' needs, their attitudes to smart technology, and what are the trends that are going to shape not only the near future, but also the midterm future as well in this space. As you mentioned in your opening, there's an awful lot of technology that is really providing a significant benefit to UK households right now. And we're really focused here at Samsung on democratizing connected living and ensuring that customers right now get the most out of their existing smart technologies. And Samsung plays a really important role in helping them do that with products like our SmartThings application that can help you bring all of that together and provide you a really seamless way of controlling the tech you've got today and no doubt the tech you're going to get in the future.
As Vice President for Samsung UK Mobile, clearly, there are lots of exciting things occurring within that. But oftentimes, one tends to feel just as you've mastered one particular form of application, it's replaced by something which appears to be much more difficult, etc. Do you feel that that kind of future tech anxiety can be effectively addressed?
Well, I think if I reflect on how people have built their smart homes already. And I say that because people do have smart homes. They might not even realize it. But what I mean by a smart home is they've got smart tech already in the home. They might just have an Alexa in the corner that they talk to or ask it to do a timer for their shopping or for their kitchen, whatever. But there's so much more that tech can already do for you. If you've got that and let's say a smart light bulb or a smart Ring doorbell, for example, then you've already got the core ingredients for a smart home. And that can enable you to actually do some quite clever stuff. What our application does is ensure that what you don't need is multiple applications to control all your different bits of smart tech in the home, no matter how many or how few you've got. The SmartThings application is a very simple, easy to use, award-winning app that runs on every operating system right across the mobile space. To ensure that you can bring all of your tech together in one simple, easy-to-use interface. And so what we're really doing here is future-proofing consumers' ability to add more smart tech over time. I think people don't go out there just to buy one smart home on a Sunday afternoon. They will aggregate and build bits of smart tech, clever bits of tech in the home, when they realize that the benefit from those pieces of technology can be quite significant. And one of the big drivers that we're seeing from this report, of course, is energy efficiency and the desire to clearly manage and control energy usage, particularly with obviously the high costs associated with energy at the moment and the need to bring down those costs and manage your bills down accordingly. And smart technology can play a really important role in that.
Fascinating to see that a third of us are using new kitchen devices or features on their existing appliances to obviously help with respect to innovation in culinary technology. Do you think it's just a short step before, again, those ready meals are actually fully computerized, delivered and fed to us?
Well, I think, again, you're right. There's some really interesting trends there. We know, obviously, post-pandemic people are cooking at home and spending more time in the kitchen than ever before. Our role as Samsung is to provide, really intuitive technology in the home environment for our customers, and none more so than in the cooking space, whether that is using our connected ovens that give you a really easy way to turn off and control that oven remotely, monitor how that oven is cooking your items. Some of our products even have a camera inside them so you can see how the product is cooking or what you're cooking and how that's progressing. Even if you're out of the home, we've got fridges that have cameras in them. And that means that you can be in the supermarket going, oh, do I have any creme fraiche or whatever? And I can immediately go to the camera via my phone and have a look and see what's in the fridge. So there's some really clever ways that technology can help us And that can help us in the kitchen, that can help us in the living room and all around the home. And this is all powered by, these type of solutions are all powered by SmartThings, which is our commitment to ensure that our technologies are connected with each other and allow easy connection between each other to ensure that consumers can get really serendipitous and highly useful engagement with their technology over as and when they need it.
Is there a day you might become the slaves to the technology as opposed to the masters?
I don't think so. I think technology has always been there to help people and make people's lives easier and simpler. I think our role at Samsung has always been to democratize technology, whether that is in mobile or whether that is in other products around the home. I think we've continually done that with the products and the innovation we bring to market, whether that's in TV, whether that's in the kitchen, in white goods, in washing machines or wherever. We're always looking to see how we can bring technology that is going to make people's lives better and richer. And I think that will always be true.
And what are you most looking forward to from your own point of view, James, in terms of what's the tech gap that you'd like to see most fulfilled by smart apps?
I don't have one particular need. I wouldn't mind a robotic lawnmower. I've got to say that's always a chore that but they exist already. I don't have one yet. But I think for me it's about just getting the most out of the technology I've already got. I've got a number of key, bits of smart technology in the home that enables me to have a more connected experience in and around the home. But I use that to my advantage. I use that to help, just set up some simple routines to manage lighting, turn off and on various devices, view CCTV cameras out the front of the house on my Samsung TV. So, simple, intuitive ways by which technology can actually make your life a bit richer. And importantly, actually can really help you save money. So I ensure that the devices I have in the home, SmartThings will help me set up to run those devices overnight when I've got a lower energy tariff, for example. So I can run my washing machine after midnight when I know I'm paying a lot less per kilowatt hour for energy. So it's simple things like that actually can be incredibly intuitive and can save you a lot of money as well.
Smart mirrors to suggest workouts based on our mental state, smart homes with energy efficient, sustainable features, smart speakers with music playing on emotions. Looks as though we're heading for a smart society. How can people actually find out untapped the home tech evolution by Samsung UK? Where would you point them, James?
Well, definitely visit our website. The report is released tomorrow. The report, which we've built in conjunction with Trend Watching, looks at future trends that may also kind of drive our industry for the next 5-10 years, as well as technology that is available right now. And of course, it's our role to ensure that we bring those types of solutions to market to meet consumers' needs. And I guess the reason we've commissioned this study is to understand a bit more about the trends that are driving consumers now, but also potentially driving consumers in the future. But you can definitely read more about that on our website, samsung.com. And of course, you can view the full Samsung Connected range of products there as well, and understand more about smart things and how simple and easy that application is to download and then to use to make all of your listeners' homes just that little bit easier to manage and control.
James Kitto, Vice President for Samsung UK Mobile. May your future be blissful indeed, James.
Thanks a lot.
Yes, I always wanted to say that to the Vice President of Samsung UK. May your future be blissful indeed, because they try to make our lives easier through tech and so on. Much as Luca Vesta obviously has a crime following with respect to obviously being the author, the creator of the Murphy and Rossi series set in Liverpool. First book of course, of the series, Dead Gone, described as darkly impressive by the Times, was a top 20 bestseller in ebook and top 30 in paperback. In paperback form, he is, of course, an ace author who's going to go head-to-head with Tom Mead, who was on the show obviously last week. Yes, it's Cozy versus Noir, Tom Mead versus Luca Vesta. How are you, Luca?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Great. Great to connect with yourself. And we also welcome our ace voiceover specialist extraordinaire, who, as Cathy, you were saying, he's probably actually the ideal person to voice Love Island or some such material. That's Philip Hurdwood. Welcome, Philip. How are you?
I'm very well, probably. That's what voiceover artists say. They say probably quite a lot, don't they, really?
Yeah, essential. Back
probably
in
the finest lager in the world. If you
indeed,
like that kind of
indeed
thing.
So.
Yeah, resoluteness being the enemy of advertising, is that it?
Something along those lines. Creative writer, of course, Robert Weston, also with us. Hopefully, Robert, you'll be catching up some of these grand events at the Newark Book Festival. And as indeed Phil Leon has pointed out, that's not Newark, New Jersey. If you go expecting to see Bruce Springsteen, you will not see him there. But you will see Luca Vesta going head to head on Saturday, the 8th of July, with Tom Mead in Cozy versus Noir. Kathy, any questions for Luca to start off with?
Yeah. How do you prepare for a panel like this? How do you prepare for a discussion?
Slap down, Tom, bring on your best.
But with books,
It's very much like the scenes in Rocky IV.
Excellent.
Where Rocky goes to Russia, and that's basically what I've been doing. But instead of in Russia, it's speak in Liverpool. there's less snow, but there's still a lot of big logs. No, I mean it's interesting to me the way that the panel has been pitched, as in like it's a kind of a battle thing, because I've always seen crime fiction as like this big umbrella of which kind of contains so many different aspects of the same kind of genre. I think it's fantastic that you can have something a lot darker, the kind of things that I write, and then the things that Tom writes, which is more cozier, and there is a room for both. So I think it's going to be one of those panels where we end up just being very nice to each other.
Which is good. I mean, in a world in which we have an awful lot of anti-feeling, etc., it'd be nice to actually ensure that there's some bonding. Robert, you were saying when you looked at, obviously, Battle of the Genres, which is even more of a knockdown, slam-out scenario between historical faction or historical fact stories, young adult fiction, and, of course, romantic fiction and so on. I'm not sure whether you thought, yes, I'm warming to this, or as a Canadian, I feel as though we should just be friends.
As a Canadian, I see what you did there. yes, that you're saying the Canadians are kind and we're all sort of...
Yes.
Kumbaya. All right.
It's actually the highest compliment when someone assumes I'm Canadian. Yeah. I go, that's so nice. Thank you.
Yeah, all right.
I mean, Philip Hurdwood, have you ever met a nasty Canadian?
I've never met a Canadian.
Well, there you are.
Wow, this is it.
Yeah.
This is the moment.
Hi, Philip. How you doing?
Anyway. No, yeah. Of course I have. Yes, and I have met some nice... Of course I have. I mean,
yeah, everybody... we have nasty people in Canada. We are not...
Just wait for those hockey games.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. Lacrosse.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, this is not... Yeah,
let's get back to Luca's text of the battles.
We need more civility in crime, don't we, Luca? Isn't that right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the idea that there isn't civility... I mean, if you go to any kind of crime festival, such as like Newark or any of the others, I mean, you will find that there is a whole bunch of people who are just really happy to be outside, at their own house and get on really well. And we all write very different things under, as I say, the umbrella of crime fiction. And we all get along, for the most part, very, very well. And I think it's a great thing.
Yeah, I think we may have oversold the V in verses in the title of this.
Not to do with me. Ask Sarah Bullimore. I mean, Sarah controls these things. I just like everybody to work well together.
Yeah, I think you're right, Luca. That it's going to be. You're going to sit down and you're going to find commonality. It's a big tent crime
genre. If nothing else, you can actually bond with Tom and have a mutual anti-Tim write-out sort of way on that sort of basis. another sort of way forward, because Tim can take it. He's brave enough.
Sure.
He was on the show last week, so there we are. Luca, let's talk Guilty Conscience. You started this off in June 2011, the Guilty Conscience blog, reviewing books that you enjoyed and interviewing, etc. Is that because... obviously, you're based in Liverpool, etc. Clearly, you'd be a Tranmere Rovers supporter, because there aren't any other real teams in Liverpool that you want to talk about there. So is that something which you think, or is it secretly you'd like to say, I was so delighted that Manchester got another side that have actually won the European Cup recently? I don't know.
I didn't see the game. I don't believe it happened.
Yeah. I'll just wave our best friend at the camera here so you can actually see City Bear just coming along to say it did actually happen. Sorry, I couldn't resist. Carry on.
Guilty Conscience was a thing that I started, that's 12 years ago now. And it was my way into crime fiction, basically, is that I was a huge reader of the genre, but I had absolutely no designs of actually writing a novel at that time. I just kind of wanted to give something back to a genre that had given me so much. I wasn't the best student And I kind of fell into work in my early 20s, and I wasn't, you know, I'd read when I was a kid, and I'd kind of fallen out of love with reading, and I kind of discovered crime fiction in my early 20s, and then tried to read everything I could get my hands on. So because I was getting so much out of it personally, I kind of wanted to get something back, so I started reviewing novels online. And it was only through that that I kind of started talking to writers, and I was interviewing them, that just one night, you know, maybe you should have a go at yourself. And I thought that, you know, there's no way that a lad from a council estate in Liverpool could ever write a novel. I thought everyone who wrote novels lived in castles down south. So I thought, do you know what, I'm going to just try. And I did. And yeah, that it suddenly became like my full-time job, like very quickly, which is really strange, but it's been like, you know, this kind of eye-opening thing for me, where it's all what I was always supposed to do. It just took someone else to just say, you know, you should have a go at this and see what it's like. And I realized I've always been a storyteller, I just didn't know it.
And it's fair to say, Luca, that Liverpool is known and renowned for its poets, its writers, and so on. So, I mean, I think on that basis, I mean, Paul McCartney does have a castle these days, I think, you know, to be fair.
Yes, he does. I think he has several.
True. Philip, any questions you'd like to put to Luca, our crime writer extraordinaire?
Well, it's, yes, I mean, it is a genre which I'm not, I have to say, very familiar with, to be honest. You know, it's really about, I love the idea. We're working on something at the moment, which is based on historical romance, and it's a true story. And and I've got a pile of books about this high, reference books. And what you're doing there is you're kind of really conducting a detective kind of search. You're putting lots of things together, lots of little clues and half hints that kind of point you down one direction. And then you find that the kind of a blind alleyway suddenly, you know, stops there, and you've got to go back somewhere else. And it's almost like the journey is of research for something of that nature is almost like a detective story. Mm. And so I'm quite drawn to that in a way of what happens next. How did that happen? How did that work out? And why did they do that? You know, and all that sort of stuff. And it's four dimensional as well, isn't it? Like four dimensional chess in a way. You know, you're trying to grasp at things that are slightly intangible. But hats off to you, because I mean, it requires a lot of plotting, doesn't it? A lot of very careful, you know, management, really, in a crime novel. And you've got to play with the audience, I guess, as well, you know, where you kind of lead them up certain paths where their expectations are going to go in that direction, but you'll bring them back and then, you know, say, ha ha, no, wrong. This is where it's going. You know? And I love that playfulness. Do you like that kind of playfulness
Yeah, I mean, you know, I read constantly within my own genre, because it is just one of those genres which has such a preponderance of books that, like, you know, you can sometimes feel like, you know, how can someone do something different within the same kind of framework of what a detective novel or a psychological thriller or anything like that. You are always looking for, always been, you know, looking for that kind of surprise. You always think, well, I've read so much now, I should be able to guess what is happening from page four. And most of the time you don't, because it has their own kind of style and way of doing things. And I think it is, you know, you're saying not familiar with the genre, but there is so many novels out there. I mean, and it's been around for a long, long time. And I think you probably read crime fiction without even realizing it most of the time.
Very good point. Yeah. Things like The Woman in White, for example, yeah. And you know, things like that, which go back to kind of late Victorian times.
Wilkie Collins.
Arguably the first kind of detective novel there ever was, I suppose, you could say.
Yeah, Moonstone. Yeah, would be the. Yeah. That's kind of the where. Also, Wilkie Collins, yeah.
And would you also encompass, obviously, Edgar Allan Poe? I mean, we've spoken on many a time on this particular program as arguably the creator of that whole detective genre. Was that an influence for you, Luca, or is it a case of don't be silly? I don't go back before, you know, Mickey Spillane.
Do you know what the best thing about Edgar Allan Poe is? Is that he basically wrote in every single genre going. You know, he wrote everything. He wrote poetry, he wrote crime fiction, he wrote mystery fiction, he wrote horror, he wrote, you know, everything. You know, he kind of crossed it. So everyone could kind of point to him as an influence. My influences came very much more contemporary, because that's what I was reading at the time when I became a writer. So it was the likes of Mark Billingham and Val McDermott and Ian Rankin and those types who were writing things that I kind of recognised better. And it wasn't until later on that I started going back through the classics and, you know, the Agatha Christie novels and that type of thing. But it is one of those genres where you could just spend your life just going straight back to the beginning and trying to get... You would never get through it. You would never get through every kind of influential author that's been out there over the past, 200 years. It would just be impossible. So I do read much more contemporary stuff, and that is more of my influence. But they themselves have been influenced by those that have come before them. So you are still, receiving that kind of
on the shoulders of giants. Luca, we're going to award you the role of music producer for this next little segment, which will take us through to the official Robert Weston intense interview with your good self. It's always good, creative writer extraordinaire. Robert's a master of the framed question and so on, which is always very good.
This is news to me. All right,
it's always important.
How long is this song?
It depends which one Luca chooses. We're going to give him two options, and they've both been in vogue in the show recently, so I think they're fair enough. First up, it's the official entry from Austria into the Eurovision Song Contest, of course, this year. Who the Hell is Edgar? It's all about Edgar Allan Poe, option one. Or, and this is going to test his Scouse credentials, Elvis Costello and the Attractions and Every Day I Write the Book. Which one are you going to go for, Luca? Now is the time.
Listen, one of my best friends in crime fiction, and if anyone knows anything about Mark Billingham, it's that he's a huge Elvis Costello fan. Unfortunately, I'm much more of a Eurovision fan.
Wow.
yes,
so,
do it.
I'm sorry, Mark, but I'm going to go for Who the Hell is Edgar, which I loved. I'm a massive Eurovision fan, and it was great to have it in the city this year, and so I'm going to go with that one.
Oh my God, you're such a good writer.
Oh, it's not me, it's Edgar.
Who the hell is Edgar?
There's a ghost in my body and he is a lyricist. It is Edgar Allan Poe and I think he can resist. Yeah, his brain is in my hand and it's moving really fast. Don't know how he possessed me, but I'm happy that he did. Cause this song is feeling special and he's gonna make me rich. Yeah, the words are spilling out. So you're about to be a star.
Funny.
as indeed Jessica Burtis from North Carolina said, many American children are delighted that that has actually entered the whole oeuvre. Philip, you looked a little bit bemused by Who the Hell Is Edgar?
Yes, that sort of music makes me feel ill, to be perfectly frank.
Wow. I mean,
that's just me, but there we are.
That was amazing.
Yeah.
That was life-changing for me because it came.
My remark or the music?
Both. Yeah, little column A, little column B. Mm. So, Luca, when you were given a choice between Eurovision versus Elvis Costello, I thought, I don't know if you saw, I was crossing my fingers for Elvis Costello. I said, there's only one choice here. It's Eurovision versus Elvis Costello. There is one choice. And then that happened. That was the great. That is a Euro.
It's just
dance,
it's the cosmos
pop song about Edgar Allan Poe with a satirical jab at Spotify. Yeah, yeah. Spotify's point. Fee structure. What? Like and Austria did not win.
10th.
Truly a crime.
They were robbed. This is a travesty that needs undoing, and I am going to lead that revolution. What?
Yeah, so
true. I mean,
you can go back and listen to Elvis Costello anytime you like. When are you ever going to be sitting there thinking I'm going to listen to the Austrian Eurovision entry?
No, yeah, Luca. You are correct. There, you are 100%. You made the right choice, and this is what is so astonishing to me. I am flummoxed by everything this morning.
And that's good crime writing for you.
And that's good radio. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. So, what questions would you like to put to Luca about life, the universe, or indeed his fondness for Eurovision?
Perhaps the universe.
I mean, wow. Okay. So, well, Luca, you said before the break there, the amazing, amazing break, that that you were, you weren't a great student. And you thought that writers lived in castles, and as you now know, they don't.
No.
Now that you're so I don't know if you know, but I teach creative writing here, and I'm also a writer, and we get students who struggle with confidence, and I think confidence on the page is one of the things. I think there is one of the many roots of so-called writer's block is confidence, that the inability to say resolutely the right choice at this moment, that's the right word, that's the right sort of story beat and narrative turn that you want to make. You want to be able to make that choice with some degree of confidence so that you can keep going. So it's something that we work on with students. I guess what I'm saying is if I'm always thinking about my young writers that I teach, and if any of them are listening, which is a dubious statement, maybe I don't know.
That's the podcast. You can point them into.
Okay, yeah. What advice would you give them to a student, to a young writer who is lacking confidence? Could you unpack a little bit how you got over that?
I mean, the ability to not be afraid of failing was what kind of drove me in the beginning. I was never supposed to be a writer. You know, all of the lads that I went to school with either ended up in prison or on the dole or in dead-end jobs that they hate. My background kind of does not lend itself well to anything kind of creative, but that is something that has always driven me. Is I enjoy entertainment more than anything, because it's an escape, and it was an escape for me because of where I came from. But I tried a number of different things because, you know, in Liverpool, if you were a lad in Liverpool, you wanted to be a footballer or a boxer, and if you failed at both of them, you tried to get a trade, and that's just difficult. And I failed at all of those things. I wanted to be a footballer, failed at that. I wanted to be a boxer, failed at that. And then I tried to get into acting. That was a failure. Singing and playing guitar and doing the pub circuits, did all that, failed at all that. Wanted to be in bands, nothing came of it. So when I started writing when I was like in my late 20s, because I had all of this kind of experience, I wasn't worried about not getting it right first time. because I always thought, well, it's not, this is not my primary goal, so like I'm not too worried. But once I started, I was like, I want to get this right. So I worked hard at what I did, but I never accepted the idea that I only get one chance at this, and I only get one chance of crafting this sentence, this paragraph, this chapter. I always gave myself the time and the ability to go, I can go back and change this anytime I like. If it's not good enough, I'll know, or someone will tell me and I can fix it, because I'm not giving up. And I think that's the issue for a lot of, you know, first-time writers, is that they think that I only get one shot at this. I only get one shot at impressing someone. That is not the case. I've never found that to be the case. You always have more opportunities, and it's just giving yourself the time and the space to explore that makes you a better writer. And it is difficult because you can't teach confidence. I've always been very, very confident. I think it comes from that kind of very low working class background where it's, you always feel everything's against you. So you kind of can either go into your shell, or you can kind of come out fighting. And I've always come out fighting, and I'm fighting against that. It doesn't bother me that when I go to anywhere to do with publishing, that my accent is the only one you'll hear. You know, there's not many people from Liverpool.
You mentioned the accent, of course, Luca, and we're doing a feature in a few moments with Kay Adams, TV personality, and indeed Proud Scot, over a survey that suggests that actually the parts of the UK most proud of their accents are indeed Scousers, Scots, and Geordies. Those people who wish to actually are most embarrassed about their accent, London, Essex and Yorkshire. So Philip Hurdwood, as a Northern Ireland chap, ever been embarrassed by your accents? And indeed, have you ever considered being one of those 25% of the country who have actually changed their accent at work, in meetings, or indeed to impress clients?
I do, right enough, that's right, so I do, No, I mean, you can't, you know, you do, I mean, well, I mean, I come from quite a kind of working class background, despite the fact that I sound probably like a member of the aristocracy, but...
I've got a castle.
I have several.
I think we can see it. That's the castle right there, isn't it?
You can, that's the castle turret. I mean, yeah, we lived in a very tiny two up, two down terraced house, you know, in the south of England. My dad worked in a bus depot as a mechanic. I mean, we're not exactly kind of elevated people, I fell into acting, I have to say, and it's much easier to go into different accents if you've got an RP accent. So that's where I kind of graduated to, really. And you know, my ordinary accent would be somewhat different to the one I was brought up with.
But, apparently, you know, in the dating world, that's where people are most likely to conceal their true accents. Indeed, accent catfishing is quite profound, the whole thing. I'm thinking,
well,
Luca,
a new one on me. My word,
this could be a theme for your next novel, Luca. Just briefly returning to your good self, let's talk about the Murphy and Rossi series. Is this a series that people can jump in on any of the text, or would you say start at the beginning and work your way through the end?
It's difficult because, you know, I get asked about the series quite often, but I haven't written the series for a number of years now. I wrote four novels in the Murphy and Rossi series, and I always kind of thought about it as being one of these long-running detective series, and it didn't quite turn out that way. I started writing different stories, so I've written another five novels following that series that don't feature Murphy and Rossi. But the Murphy and Rossi I'm kind of happy that it is just those four novels. And I think if you do read them from the beginning and you go through and read those four, you can see where he begins. Murphy is the main character, and Rossi is his kind of sidekick, and you can see where they end up. It is just in those four novels, kind of like this, you know, tightly packed kind of big journey that you can go on with them. And yeah, it was strange because it was set in Liverpool, and you know, there was serial killers and that type of thing, and Liverpool isn't known for its serial killers. I think we've had one in the past 100 years, which is, you know, it's fiction, but I felt a little bit like, you know, taking liberties.
Once Morse took up residence in Oxford, it became like a murder capital of Europe, basically.
Exactly.
For the whole system.
I mean, it's not like Midsummer, you know. It's not. It wasn't like, you know, I was going too far, but I still write books that are set in Liverpool mostly, and you know, it's just about different kind of stories that I'm interested in right now. and it's much more about the kind of ordinary person being thrown into an extraordinary situation. Mm-hmm. I just feel like that is much more what I'm interested in. I didn't know anything about detectives or anything like that when I started writing, so I kind of lent on, you know, what I was reading, and so I feel like what I'm writing now is a bit more authentic and a bit more of interest to me to write. So like the novel that, you know, we're talking about in the panel will be You Never Said Goodbye, which is actually set mostly in America. And that was based on a very personal story to me, and it was, and because of that, it felt more authentic to write, and I think it's a more authentic read.
Mm, yep. We could go on to talk about the two crime writers and a microphone podcast, which is always quite nice. Two crime writers and a microphone. Says it all. What you need for good broadcasting these days. And, of course, being co-founder of the Locked In Festival. Is that a COVID reference by any chance?
Yeah, so it's actually the Locked Up Festival. If for some reason, on my bio, it said the Locked In Festival for about 3 years, and I keep asking to people to change it, but it never seems to happen. I've done this lots of times.
It's as bad as somebody actually booking you for February the 16th of June without realising that's a Friday as opposed to a Thursday.
Yeah,
it's so confusing, you know? I mean, how that could have happened, I just don't know. I mean, obviously...
I don't know anyone who would do that kind of thing.
Madness. sheer madness. I can only put it down to my joy for Pep Guardiola. Sorry, never mind.
No, the Locked Up Festival was very much a COVID thing. It was myself and Steve Kavanagh, a crime writer from Northern Ireland, who decided that we wanted to put on a festival during the pandemic, because we basically missed festivals, and it was our opportunity to kind of see all our friends again, even despite it being on screen. And because we thought, well, how do we get all of these people to do this, you know, take up their time? And we decided to, you know, make it a charity thing. So we ended up raising over £25,000 for the Trussell Trust. We had hundreds of people who came and saw numerous events that we put together, and we did it twice, and it was a huge undertaking, but it was massive fun. It was great fun, and we had some amazing panels that we put together, and it was great. It was great, and to raise all that money for such a worthy cause was fantastic.
Well, look, we're looking forward to catching up with you, obviously, in a Newark Town Hall, 3 to 4 p.m. on June the... not June, what was I? Get the date right. On July the 8th, Saturday, July the 8th, Cozy versus Noir. It's going to be tremendously awesome, terrifically awesome, and so on. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer on the programme today, though? Has it been good for you?
Yes, of course.
This is good.
Always.
Phil Hurdwood, has it been good for you as well?
Yes, it has. Yes, I've learned a lot too. Yeah. I've learned about the kind of music I like and dislike. I got a new insight into crime fiction, and I'm going to start kind of doing a bit more of that, a bit more reading on that. Oh, I'm writing a horror at the moment. Well, I've written a horror film script, which is kind of moving forward. But it's psychological horror. But you know, yeah, I mean, it's crime fiction. I mean, there is an awful. It's very, very popular because it gets your mind working.
It's a
it?
Broad church. So, Luca, will you be kind enough to return
exactly
to the Midweek Drive in the not too distant future? Will you come back possibly after the festival?
Of course, anytime. Excellent. I don't do anything else.
Luca, thank you very much for your comments about confidence and how to get it. I think what you said about writing being all about rewriting. I am going to point my students in the direction of this.
It won't be long, Luca, before we'll be inviting you to become a visiting professing speaker at the University of Lincoln. I'm sure.
Oh, now wouldn't that be something for a little council estate kid from Liverpool to be a visiting professor? Yeah. Will they get a robe? I want a cape.
Get him a cipher.
I think we'll look towards that. And Phil Hurdwood, will you also return?
Oh, I suppose I might if pushed.
All right.
Well, I'd love to, of course I would, you know.
Acknowledging, obviously, the joys of Elvis Costello fans and acknowledging the fact that clearly there is a commonality between Man City fans and indeed those fans of Liverpool and Everton. Are you Liverpool, Everton or Tranmere or neither?
Liverpool fan.
Okay.
Get it right.
I mean, I could have played Rodri's goal. No, I'll hold fire on that. But I'll hold that. But what I will actually say is this is something we can bond over. It's Elvis Costello, and he never, ever wanted to go to Chelsea. Cheerio, Luca. Take care. Be well. Be safe.
Thanks,
be happy.
Thank you.
Photographs of fancy tricks that get your kicks in.
Everybody's got new orders. Be a nice girl and kiss the waters. Now the teacher is away. All the kids begin to play. Photographs of fancy tricks to get your kicks at 66. And thinks of all the lips that it licks. And all the girls that is a gold to fix. She gave a little flirt, gave us up a little cuddle. That there's no place to see a bottom and a skirt waddle. Dabbles of punishment, she's last year's model. They call her the Dasher when she looks like Elsa. I don't want to go to Chelsea. Oh no, that's not moonlight. Seeing the movie, I don't want to check your books. I don't want nobody else. I don't want to go to Chelsea.
Splendid, absolutely splendid, as we actually await our next guest to actually come through. You're listening to Siren Radio, and it's the Midweek Drive Morning Edition live. In case you're wondering, and you might be, Kathy, you might just be wondering, what happens at 11 o'clock on Siren Radio?
Well, it's what happens at 11 o'clock every time on Siren Radio.
Is that so? Every time? Well, every Thursday,
every
shall we
Thursday
say.
Every Thursday and so Tuesday.
So. Conversation events take place in Lincoln. Marvellous. It's like groundbreaking in so many ways. Presented by David Harding Price. That's Lincoln and Levinson's, which is the programme that follows Midweek Drive Morning Edition live. At the heart of Ukraine, of course, up with your good self, Kathy. Anything you'd like to tease ahead to the piece for this week?
Yeah, you're going to get to meet this man by the name of Vova. He, Ukrainian.
It's Vova, not Volvo.
Vova,
nice.
V-O-V-A, Vova. Yep. Yeah, he has a very interesting story. I don't want to give away too much because you should listen, but he has truly something inspirational, and half his family lives in Russia right now.
That makes interesting listening, as indeed does the Siren Jukebox. And then, of course, it's Chris Clarkson with the Drive Time Show between 5 and 7 before we have a Resonance Rewind, which I think this week is perusing a Dollhouse, if memory serves. I could be wrong, but anyway, it's still very. We're doing something along those sort of lines. Robert, what sort of things are you getting involved with over this fine Thursday, June day?
Today? Yeah, it's more of the same, really. I'm just
more
reading.
Same,
yeah. I'm reading.
And listening to
work.
Austria's Eurovision Song Contest.
I will be listening to. What are they called? Who are they? We don't know what they're called. Austria's entry into Eurovision.
We just know.
Yeah,
the song.
I will listen to it on repeat while I read. So every all of my comments on my student work today will just say, you know,
Taya.
It could have been better. It could have been better. For
yeah,
more
Taya,
Poe.
Taya,
more Poe.
And so yeah, more Poe. Could work that. Poe. Enough of such stuff. PM Dawn, a sort of P, keeping the alliteration going. Set Adrift on Memory Bliss.
Baby, you send me, yeah. Set adrift on memory bliss. So
The camera pans, the cocktail glass, behind a blend of plastic plants. I find the lady with a fat diamond ring. Then you know I can't remember a damn thing. I think it's one of those deja vu things, or a dream is trying to tell me something.
Set adrift on Memory Bliss, it's almost like listening to the joyous words of Kay Adams. Kay's back with us. How are you, Kay?
I am, and I was enjoying that great summer sound there. Looking out at the blue skies, listening to that music. Absolutely perfect. Thank you, Alex.
Very much so. Now, we've just been speaking to a writer from Liverpool who is rightly very proud of his accent as a Scouser. And indeed, we've also talked to Northern Ireland folk, etc. Geordies, why we can do that as well. Pet, obviously, as a Scot. We're all part and parcel of this wholesale notion, this survey that suggests that actually accents are still very significant in terms of our everyday life. Kay, share with us what is it that basically makes the Scottish accent just so wonderful, especially when orated by your good self?
I know, well, I don't know if I'm the best person to judge, but I mean, you were saying there that accents are still very significant. I think they're becoming more and more significant. You know, there was a time whereby if you came from a region, and I say that with my fingers going like that, you know, you would try and sort of bland out your accent or posh it up a little bit. I think those days are long gone, and we're now at a time that we absolutely celebrate our accents and where we come from and what they represent. And indeed, that's what KLM wants to do, you know, by celebrating local communities. And, you know, the Scottish accent, once upon a time, I'm ashamed to say I really dumbed down my Scottish accent.
No.
Oh, I did. I got my first job in Birmingham, Alex, once I left university. And, you know, I suppose there was an element of, you know, people out of fun would say, oh, hi, hoot, mon, the new, and please, all that kind of stuff, which was all...
A Glaswegian kiss would result, Kay.
Oh, you've obviously been north. But, you know, we've come such a long way from then. And as you say, Scouse are so proud of their city. I mean, my goodness, Eurovision, they did such a brilliant job with that, didn't they? And we heard lots of Scouse accents. And we need to hear our accents in every walk of life, you know, in our workplaces, in our social lives, on television, on radio, to really appreciate the kind of rich diversity of the UK.
Well, in the studio, we have a fine soul from Miami, Florida, of course. And I think it's fair to say, Kathy Mancy, you've been interested in this whole line of things, particularly, Kay, as I pointed out, that Loose Women is probably the ideal show to actually watch after you've seen Love Island. I mean, Kathy was not aware of Loose Women. Anyway.
I keep learning so much about the entertainment industry in this country.
You do. Can I just say, the title Loose Women, don't get the wrong idea.
Okay. I appreciate that. Thank you. That helps.
That link with Love Island and Loose Women, honestly, that's not what you're thinking.
I just, you know, once someone introduced me to Naked Attraction, I just got very confused. Very confused.
Any questions for Kay, Kathy?
I guess, how, well, what, how did you find your passion into accents, I guess? Did it start from your own community or was it going into other communities?
Well, you know, right from a child, actually, you know, going on holiday, you know, whether it was abroad to Mallorca or wherever, or at home, you're always going to meet people from different parts of the country and indeed different parts of the world. And, you know, as a child, that's musical on your ears, isn't it? Because you want to expand your horizons. You want to find out about, you know, different places and different people. That's part of our great love of travel, isn't it? Mm. You know, sort of going to other places and seeing how other people live. So I don't think I was necessarily, and I don't know if anyone is conscious of, you know, how they get intrigued by accents. It starts at such a young age, but I loved it. I remember going on holiday when I was about 8 and I met a wee girl from Northern Ireland. And I mean, I thought in a Northern Ireland accent. I think I'm quite good at it, actually, but I won't offend Northern Irish people. And she tried the Scottish accent. And, you know, that was just it. And it is, you know, it's not taking the mickey. Sometimes it can be seen as taking the mickey out of people if you speak with their accent. But certainly the way that I would approach it, and most people, it's sharing joy of their accent, you know.
Which, of course, ties in with KLM, serving 17 destinations across the UK and indeed looking to get people involved with the latest advertising campaign, Fly It Home, or in Newcastle, Fly It Home.
Well, yeah, and what a great opportunity that is from KLM. I love their take on this, because as you say, they do fly from 17 local airports across the UK. Yours will be Humberside, I would imagine, as it is the nearest to you in Lincoln. Am I right? No?
Robin Hood, I think, yeah. Probably. Would
East
be.
Oh, right, okay. Yes, apologies Midlands. For yeah. that. Yes. Oh, yeah, okay. And so they are giving the opportunity to three people to be the voiceover artist for KLM adverts. Mm. So they'll give us someone from Scotland, Northeast, and from Wales. And so they can put forward a little tape. If you're interested in doing it, it's promoentries.com/ KLM Local Voices 2023. Put forward a little tape and you could find yourself broadcasting across the airwaves this autumn for the new KLM ad. How about that?
Well, I'm just wondering, we also have in the studio creative writer and tutor, of course, Robert Weston. Robert, of course, from Canada. So yes, I won't indeed. Go into a boot anything or any way, shape,
this
or form.
Is yeah. true. What a multicultural show we have today. This is fabulous.
Yeah, all of the Englishes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you Canadians get fed up being called Americans, and do you Americans get fed up being mixed up for Canadians? Does that bother you?
I don't. I find it really interesting that there is what I've noticed is a tremendous amount of anxiety amongst British people about making this mix up, and I get a lot of people asking, "Are you American?" And then I say, "No, I'm Canadian," and then they apologize profusely. Yeah. And I guess I don't understand, because I don't know where the offended Canadians are. I've never...
No, I can tell you this from being American on this side. Yeah. See, I get people asking if I'm Canadian, and I have to say, no, but thank you, that's very kind, because I think they're going from my personality being very warm and hospitable, and they are like, oh, I wouldn't have guessed you're American, and I think
because you're so kind,
exactly,
because you're so
exactly.
So what is the this I find interesting is I find it very illuminating that Americans are incredibly apparently self-effacing and think that they are monstrous people
I don't personally, yeah. but
I mean that
I'm
then,
buttoned out of this completely.
Yeah.
And then
British people are very concerned about mistaking, and maybe this is it, and maybe I am living up to the
let's all get together and watch an episode of Loose Women. It'll be a lot better. I'll work on that side of things. Okay, how can people actually just follow through with respect to this particular item? Where would you point them in terms of going online and such like for Accents and KLM's work?
Well, let me just repeat that link that I gave you before. Promo entries. I hope my accent is saying this nicely enough. .com/. See, I'm going posh. Why am I doing that? I'll do it in Scottish. Promoentries.com/ KLM Local Voices 2023. I hope you understood that Scottish accent.
It was
you?
Perfect.
Or do you want me to do it in the Queen's English as well? Promoentries.com/ KLM Local Voices 2023.
That's more difficult to understand.
Do you know, it's so funny that you say that. I remember really quickly, I was at a dinner party in London, and my friend, who's terribly posh, spoke like that. And there was a Spanish guy there who was a student. And at one point, my posh friend said to Carlos, I do hope that you understand Kay's accent, because she's Scottish, you see. And Carlos said, well, actually, Johnny, I understand Kay's accent better than I understand yours. And I was like, result! This is my
yes, because it is a competition.
And that is why.
Good-natured.
It's only a matter of time before we actually have Dame Kay Adams. It'll happen in the new year or somewhere along the line. Kay, it's been awesome connecting with you, good self, as ever.
Lovely to speak to you all.
Likewise, take care and keep on keeping on.
Thank you, bye.
2 hours ago, we started off with Dr. Hiva Fasihi and, of course, the notion of sun cream. We went on to Tim Slate, who, of course, is the Finance and Administration Manager for the Lincolnshire Agricultural Society. Next week, we will be at the Lincolnshire Show, and you will be with us too, dear listener, we hope, because we'll be providing you with audio postcards from the show to actually savour. And maybe we might see you there. If we see a couple of souls wandering around looking a bit lost, well, that might be the Siren Radio team, or maybe not. William Sitwell, of course, we give a huge thanks to for his views from the culinary world, and of course his latest bottle of choice, which is out there as well. You can actually access that by going to his website. And of course Philip Hurdwood joined up with the accent connections of course our wonderful soul from Liverpool, of course the wonderful Versa, who's actually there, who's doing wonderful things in all so many ways. I'm emotionally overwhelmed. Perhaps it's because of his Liverpool background. We forgot, of course, James Kitto, of course, from the world of Samsung, and Kay Adams, who wrapped up the whole sequence inevitably with respect to her Scottish scenario, and hopefully put Kathy correct on the notion that Love Island, Loose Women need to be watched separately.
Understood.
Very important.
Will do.
Robert Weston, have you enjoyed your Midweek Drive Morning Edition live?
Yes, I have. This was my first morning edition, wasn't it? I've never done the morning before.
It's primarily because most of the times I'm actually teaching at this time, so we've actually sort of been live. Summer, it's been pre-recorded, so there we are.
Oh, great. So this is a way for me to get up early in the summer, is basically what you've done here.
Exactly,
yes.
Exactly.
Thank you, question mark.
So this is and, of course, you have had your life-changing experience of listening to Who the Hell is Edgar?
Unforgettable.
Yeah.
Yeah, seared into my psyche for all time. Precisely. It really was life-changing. I mean...
Yeah. This is it. This says it all. Kathy, obviously, the heart of Ukraine coming up in a couple of hours or so from now. A little bit more than 2 hours.
Yeah.
That's it. Stay tuned to Siren Radio. Up next, as mentioned, Elevenses, Lincoln Elevenses, no less, with the accent-interested David, who'll be talking us through a whole variety of other bits and pieces as well. News, of course, at 11 o'clock. To Robert West, to Kathy Manso, to you, dear listener, happy trails, and can we all say farewell for now?
Farewell for now.
Farewell for now.
On white horses, let me ride away to my world of dreams so far away. Let me run to the sun, to a world my heart can understand. It's a gentle, warm and wonderland far away. Stars away, where the clouds are made of candy floss. As the day is born, when the stars are gone, we'll race to meet the dawn. So when I can only see the gray of a sad and very lonely day, that's when I softly sigh. On white horses, snowy white horses, let me ride away. As the day is born, when the stars are gone, we'll race to meet the dawn. So when I can only see the grey of a sad and very lonely day, that's when I softly sigh. On white horses, snowy white horses, let me ride away, 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 away.
Siren Radio.